You want people to reach out and say, hey, how come you're not funding this? Or how come you're not researching this? Or I love that you're researching this. Can you do more? Like that, you want that from as many people in the SCI community as you can get.
Absolutely. How else are we going to get away from tokenism? We only can have so many people on our programmatic panel, on our peer review panel. We need the voices of the community to tell us whether we're doing a good job or not.
That was Melissa Miller from CDMRP, who's joined by Jackie Roach, also from CDMRP, and you heard her. Check our liner notes for the way that you can speak up and raise your voice about what they should be prioritizing and funding. This is the CureCast podcast, brought to you by Unite to Fight Paralysis, the podcast we hope feeds the movement we need to cure paralysis from spinal cord injury. Welcome back. It's been a while. A couple of things I want to mention to you really quickly before we get into the conversation. First off, check our website, u2fp.org, to find out how you can speak up and lend your voice to protecting our Minnesota Research Grant Program, which we talk about later in the podcast. Second, check our website also to find out information about the upcoming Working to Walk Science and Advocacy Symposium. Lastly, you can always email at us at curecast@u2fp.org. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, here we go. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to CureCast, episode 49, with the ladies from SCRP, as I like to refer to them, Dr. Melissa Miller. Hello, Melissa.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Jackie Roche. Hello, hey, Jackie. There. Howdy. And of course, my podcast partner, Jason Stouffer. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
So, first off, Jackie, where are you?
I am in Frederick, Maryland.
Are you in an office? Are you in your house?
I am standing proudly in my kitchen.
Wow.
Proudly.
And what's it like there?
In my kitchen or Frederick?
Both.
Kitchen, my Nespresso maker is kind of staring me down, so excited for that experience here in a little bit. And Frederick, where I'm at, is actually incredibly peaceful and inviting, so I'm grateful to be located here right now.
Cool. Nice. Melissa, what about you?
I am in Rockville, Maryland, hanging out in my office that I share with my wife, but she got kicked out because I get to use the office today. Ha ha.
Is she staring you down like Jackie's espresso machine?
She might be at the door staring me down. Yeah.
Okay. Don't look.
Hanging out with the dog. I needed to, you know, kick out any extraneous noise from the room.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah, I think it's important before we move on to, I just want to throw in there, you guys are representing my old stomping grounds. So I was born in Silver Spring, Maryland, in a place called Holy Cross Hospital. And we lived in the Rockville area. I grew up in kind of Rockville, actually a place called Aspen Hill is where I grew up. And then, And then my mom wound up moving to Frederick, Maryland, and was there last probably decade or so before she actually just passed away this year. But yeah, you guys are kind of representing my my old stomping grounds there.
It's a small world after all.
Sure enough.
This will be kind of a magical podcast.
It already is, Matt. I'm feeling the magic.
100%.
So, Jason, I'm guessing you're in your motor home on the property.
Oh, I thought you were going to guess like what I'm wearing, but I am in my little motor home. Actually, this would not be specifically a motor home since it doesn't have a motor. This is a fifth wheel trailer. I officially live in a trailer, and for now, but close to me is my soon to be actual adobe that we are working on. Adobe abode. But yes, right now I'm in the fifth wheel.
All right.
Okay.
So we're all situated, and I'm here in Minneapolis in our office and looking at a bright sunny sky, which is kind of nice, nice change of pace. Melissa and Jackie, whichever one of you wants to go first, tell us a little bit about your background and what led you or leads you to where you are today.
Take it away, Melissa.
Sure. So I started way back in undergrad doing small molecule development. I was a synthetic organic chemist. It was really cool. I caught the research bug early, but thought that I was going to, jump ship and go into industry. And then the recession hit. And then you ask which one, but I won't talk to you about that. That will age me. Went and got a PhD in cellular and molecular medicine in a neuroscience lab. Still within that sort of drug development scope, but decided that if I was not going to jump ship to industry, that I wanted to do this one technique in electrophysiology. So I wanted to do electrophysiology, but I wanted to do it in reproductive biology. So I moved from neuroscience to reproductive biology, doing contraception development and understanding mechanisms of male factor infertility, which was incredibly fascinating and made me very popular at dinner parties. It was great. My graduate school was very interesting time. Graduate school and postdoc. But so I always knew that my path was not in academic researcher. And I luckily stumbled into a research grants administration job supporting the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Programs right after my postdoc, and have been climbing up the ranks ever since. And now I am the program manager here at SCRP.
So I'm really curious what, when you said, I knew I didn't want to stay in academic science, why is that?
It's really difficult to be married to multiple things at once, including your job and your wife.
So you mean like teaching and science and running a lab and writing grants and all that stuff?
Exactly. All of it. You have to dedicate, to be good at it, you have to dedicate your entire life to it. Or at least that's how I felt. Mm. And that just really wasn't my path. I wanted, outside interests besides just, being in lab almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So that brings us to now, what's your role and what organization are you working for and kind of what was that path to where you are presently?
Yeah, so right now I am the program manager for the Spinal Cord Injury Research Program within the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Programs. That is a very long title. But what that means is that I am the team lead for essentially running a program that is dedicated to traumatic spinal cord injury. So I started off as a science officer, which is someone who interacts directly with our funded investigators, helping them through the process of getting into business with the government. And now I'm on the other side, trying to make sure that we do that job as well, but also making sure that what we're asking investigators to deliver to us is in line with the needs of the stakeholder.
And how long have you been with SCRP, both in the role working with the researchers there as that kind of liaison, and then now also directing?
Yeah, so I have been with SCRP for about 3 or 4 years. And I have been the program manager now. I just hit my 1 year anniversary, kind of last week, my anniversary would have been November.
Jackie, how about you?
Well, first off, nowhere near as cool as Melissa. So if we could just manage expectations up front, that would be fantastic.
That's not accurate at all.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but you're wearing mustard today.
We are a mustard
elevates,
gang now.
Yeah, it elevates. Go ahead.
And I don't know about that, Jackie. I've talked to you for a little bit, and I think you're pretty dang cool. So, but anyhow, go ahead with your, tell us your background and how you ended up where you are now.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Hype Man. So, long road, but I'll start somewhere in the middle. So I got my master's in rehabilitation and mental health counseling in 2015. And then I commissioned into the Army as an intelligence officer with the 82nd Airborne Division, 2nd Brigade Combat Team, and served with 2325 Airborne Infantry Regiment and 173 KEV. Got to do everything I wanted and then some, could not rave about my time both in grad school and with the Army more, but I'd kind of accomplished that dream. And so when I was looking to transition in January 2019, this position honestly almost fell into my lap. So I'm a consumer reviewer administrator with General Dynamics. And it's really truly a merge of what I would go ahead and humble brag and say are my talents. And I fell in love. So I've been doing this for a little over a year now.
So repeat that again, consumer engagement.
Consumer reviewer administrator, or internally we call ourselves, for the CRAs, yes.
At General Dynamics.
Yes.
So explain that a little bit.
Absolutely. So I actually work with quite a few programs, but SCRP, I would say, is my number one baby. This is one that I really kind of took, and it had been a little bit of trouble, I think, for previous CRAs, and I just ran with it. They said, hey, see what you can do. And I just set myself on fire and went forward, and talk about fruitful. So again, work with a couple of different programs. This is one of 10 for my upcoming assignments list for this year. So kind of having to juggle a bunch of different topics and a bunch of different relationships, but it keeps me on my toes, keeps things exciting for sure. But I have the honor of reaching out to individuals to serve on the peer review side of our process. And they lend their voices, their stories, their, as Jason is such a prominent example of, their sense of humor, their lightheartedness and perspective into, you know, things such as quality of life or impact on our applications in terms of peer review and awarding grant applications. So it gets a little nerdy there at the end, but the upfront piece is just honestly collecting wonderful humans, hearing their stories and saying, hey, let me put you in the room with the right people and give you a voice. Mm-hmm.
Well, we do want to kind of move on and have both of you give us a really good background on the CDMRP. But before we do that, you guys have mentioned at least three entities that kind of play together, the characters in this thing. And it can be kind of confusing. I mean, having gone through the process a little bit as a reviewer, I was trying to figure out, okay, what role does everybody actually play here? But, you know, we've mentioned Congress, right? We've kind of mentioned, the Department of Defense plays a role in this as well. And then General Dynamics, Jackie, as you mentioned, also plays a role. Just real quickly, before we even get into the background on some of this stuff, can you just sort of nest those players?
Yeah, sure. I'll take this. The money, the people who write our checks are Congress. Congress says the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program, you will have this amount of money to fund research and development into these specific topics. For us, it's SCRP, it's the Spinal Cord Injury Research Program. And then to execute those dollars, CDMRP lives within the Department of Defense. So the way that those that money travels is from Congress within the president's budget to the Department of Defense down to the, I'm not going to give you another acronym soup, don't worry, down finally to us. I was going to go there. I'm not going to. To us. And then we have different contract companies who do various jobs. One of them is our peer review contractors. They're the ones that run that scientific peer review and get our consumer reviewers on board. They're the ones that do that initial scientific review. We have another contract that is responsible for our secondary review or programmatic review, but we won't talk about them. We're just here to talk about the peer review.
So,
right?
So
GDS is the most important.
So just so it's clear to me, the General Dynamics does both the scientific review and the peer review.
That is the scientific review.
In the whole, yeah. So, not to separate them.
Sounds like it's not going to be clear to you, Matt. No, that is a so. But what you were saying, Melissa, I believe is that the part of the folks that contract, or one of the folks that contract with you, is General Dynamics, and that's what and that piece that you were contracting out to General Dynamics is what Jackie's doing in soliciting, finding peer reviewers for the program.
That's right. That's what GDIT does for us. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I kind of misspoke sort of from my own sort of community swirl. I guess what I was trying to say is it's both a peer review of scientists, clinicians, but it's also the SCI reviewers or advisors. So General Dynamics houses both of those facets of the entire review process.
Yes, our scientific peer review consists of both that the scientists, right, and clinicians, as well as the people with lived experience.
Right.
So
right.
Our SCI consumer reviewers.
So yeah, this would be actually a really good time with that little bit of background to just sort of delve into. So we, in a nutshell, we have this program that is a national program. Congress mandates it, and it is funding. And what's, I mean, really special for our community is that this is this specific. The SCRP is spinal cord injury research program. So these dollars are specific to spinal cord injury. How did congressionally directed programs, how did they come about? What's the background there? What's their history?
Sure. So the foundation of CDMRP was established with our first congressional appropriation in 1992. And that was as a direct result of patient advocacy groups, primarily within the breast cancer research space. And it's because of their efforts, and efforts like consumer advocacy groups like you guys are a part of, that Congress continues to be aware of health and healthcare issues. So as a result of that first appropriation and the efforts of the consumer advocacy groups, CDMRP has grown from that single topic of breast cancer research. Now over 30 programs are managed by CDMRP with 30 different congressional appropriations. So as the name suggests, it's Congress that is directing us to fund, as you said, within these specific research areas. Mm-hmm. So for SCRP, Congress writes into the budget, and this is on top of the annual defense appropriations budget, that CDMRP will have an appropriation of $30 million towards spinal cord injury research.
And now, is that a set amount? Does that amount change annually? And like, kind of what would be the average, I guess, if it changes annually? And these are a lot of questions I'm throwing at you, but so one, is it a set amount? Two, does it change? And then I guess my third one, when you answer those, is how does that compare to some other of the larger national or federal grant dollars, such as NIH?
That's a great question. So is it stable? Actually, it's been pretty stable. So SCRP was stood up in 2009 with a $30 million appropriation. And it dipped a little bit in 2012. That was when, you know, bad things were happening with the economy. But popped back up to $30 million and had been there since $30 million for 7 or 8 years. So in this past year, in FY20, we actually got up to $40 million. So we had been stable at 30, now we popped up to 40. And for this next year, what we're trying to execute now, this FY21 budget, we're still at $40 million. So does it have to stay stable? No, it doesn't have to. Has it been stable? Yes, Congress has been pretty consistent with how much money it allocates or appropriates to SCRP. How does that compare to other funding entities? So the other funding entities don't really have a set amount that goes to spinal cord injury research. It is going to be dependent upon what they get, what types of applications they get per year, right? So NINDS doesn't have a, you know, spinal cord injury specific appropriation. But generally speaking, they're within the $80 million a year area. And we're in the $40 million.
But that 80 is specifically to specifically to spinal cord and neuro, or do you know? I mean, on the
yeah.
NIH.
So for the NIH, for the NIH's arm of specifically spinal cord injury research, at least for this last year, it was around $80 million.
Mm. Yeah, and right. It's fluctuates. I mean, it's been up.
It will absolutely fluctuate.
Over 90, 93 million. It kind of goes back and forth. I'm curious, under that 30, and then you just, Melissa, you just said 40 million, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we popped up to $40 million this past year.
In that 40 million, are there, are there descriptors for kinds of buckets underneath that?
Mm.
You know, of sort of strategic focus, is that divvied up in different ways, whether on the front end as a mandate or, you know, how it breaks down? How does that 40 million break down into categories of investigation or strategic areas?
So our primary objective, SCRP's primary objective, is to deliver on the congressional intent of the program, right? We wouldn't be here without Congress. So we want to make sure that we're delivering on what their needs are. So based off of the language that we've been provided, our main intent is to be a traumatic spinal cord injury research and treatment program with a focus on regeneration, rehabilitation, and long-term care that balances investment across acute and chronic injury and favors research with a more advanced stage of development. You know, not a big ask at all. And of course, all of our research that we fund must be relevant to military health. So how how we deliver on that intent. So that's our swim lane, right? That's the area that we need to lie in. And then how we deliver on that intent is reevaluated annually. So every year we set out our annual metrics with what type of projects we want to fund and in what areas within spinal cord injury research. So last year we had 5 what we call focus areas. And these are meant to target our investment into areas we believe are of greatest need for our stakeholders for that year. This year, those needs might change given the metaphorical highlighter that COVID has taken to specific issues within the SCI community.
And who makes that decision?
Yeah, we have a panel of subject matter experts, and that panel of experts consists of clinicians and researchers and people with lived SCI experience. It also includes other funding agencies so that we can make sure that we're leveraging off of their knowledge of what they're funding. And so we're not stepping on one another's toes or, continuing to fund the same things.
Well, I noticed too, at least during my experience with you guys, that and I actually didn't catch this until the end, but we were divvied up into what were it almost seemed like functional groups. I think there may have been like a device kind of group or something, STEM or something like that, or a bowel bladder or sexual, or maybe like a psychological. It seemed like we were kind of split into sort of these like categories. Maybe that's the kind of thing that Matt was alluding to, like what categories do these things get, does this money get dropped into for research? But is that true? I mean, the working groups have a specific focus.
Well, so our peer review is set up dependent upon what types of applications we get in the door that year. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that if you compare if we're comparing a application that comes in under our psychosocial focus area, and we're trying to compare that to a bladder bowel sexual function or a electrical stimulation application, that they may that it would be very difficult to have every one of those applications get a fair shake in a diverse it would be really difficult to get every application a fair shake. So what we do is those applications that we get in are divvied up across different panels. And those panels, again, are going to change every year depending on what applications we get in. So you may, there may be consumers that sit on a device-specific panel. There may be a specifically a psychosocial panel. There may be specific to, biomarkers that year. But it's really going to depend on the applications that we get. But I think what you're trying to get at is, what are those 5 focus areas that we're investing in?
Right. Yeah. And I think for our listeners as well, for them to, mm-hmm. to actually, what you just said was great. I mean, to know that there are these specific focus areas and that they all kind of get this fair shake at the research funds is just pretty cool. And I guess that's actually what I was really, really fishing for.
Yeah, I mean, but that's really important because, if you're trying to compare the scientific qualities of a very early stage discovery type award or discovery type application versus a well-developed clinical trial, it's going to be very difficult to try to cross-compare those. So we need to make sure that the applications that are being reviewed are being reviewed fairly and within, you know, similar confines.
Right. Go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say, it strikes me as an interesting puzzle, given all the various, you know, from the beginning of this thread of the conversation, you know, the categories of regeneration. I think it was regeneration, was it rehabilitation, and then mm-hmm. care. So there's that rubric, right? And then you have the annual strategic mandate from your panel of clinicians, researchers, and SCI community, but also other funding agencies, right? And then that's mm-hmm. mixed in with how you're sort of putting what comes to you in what buckets. Is that a fair assessment of what you're kind of describing? Because I'm imagining that's kind of a complex process.
It is complex, but remember, so our focus areas, most of the applications, depending on the funding mechanism, but for the most part for SCRP, most of our applications need to align to at least one of the current SCRP focus areas. And so we'll talk about last year's, because this year's, we haven't developed this year's funding strategy, okay. So I can't speak to them. But so last year we had 5 focus areas. So all of our applications, for the most part, had to align to one of those 5 focus areas. We had one for acute injury, so to speak. We had one for rehabilitation and regeneration. We had one for psychosocial. We had one for bowel, genitourinary, cardiopulmonary, and pain. And then we had a 5th one, and I don't know which ones I've already covered, but each of our applications will fit into one of those, topics. And then it's a lot easier then, once we have the big buckets, to then distribute down and separate out into much smaller buckets for peer review.
Okay.
I have a quick question for you, Melissa or Jacqueline. So the SCRP itself, the Spinal Cord Injury Research Program within the CDMRP, it is, are all of the mandated, the congressionally mandated medical research programs, like you said that there are multiple and started with breast cancer, are all of them managed through the DOD, or is SCRP specifically managed through the DOD? And I guess the reason I'm asking is I wonder if some of the staying power of some of this funding may have to do with injuries of war, you know, IEDs and things that actually would bring about spinal cord injuries.
So I want to answer your question in 2 ways. One, all of the, so CDMRP sits within the Department of Defense. So all of our programs and all of the projects that are funded through our programs must be relevant to military health. And that goes for SCRP, and that goes for breast cancer, and that goes for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. Okay. Goes for all of them. However, you hit on a very important point. So SCRP was stood up in 2009. That's when a lot of our veterans were coming back with those traumatic injuries of war that you were just commenting on. So absolutely, one of the reasons why SCRP was stood up was absolutely because of the injuries that our warfighters were sustaining.
Okay, yeah, that explains a lot.
So I want to pull Jackie back in. Are you still here, Jack? Did you fall asleep?
Never.
Not that this was an interesting conversation, I admit, but just a bit. It's been a while since we actually said your name. I want you to describe, I mean, you know, one of the things that I think I'm really fascinated by and really interested to talk about is how both sort of as a mandate, but also functionally, like practically, how does it work? You know, you mentioned earlier that your job is to find all these beautiful people to beautiful, wonderful people to participate in the process like Jason. So tell us a little bit about how that intersects with what Melissa's just been describing, you know, kind of higher level structure. Give us a little flavor of, okay, how many people, how do you find them? Where are they in the process of both on the reviewing and advising, but also tell us all about labs that have to have somebody in there, you know, advising them in their lab, like a consultant.
I don't know how much I can honestly speak to that last part. My only understanding of folks jumping into the research is I just need to be able to deconflict in terms of conflicts of interest. So that's definitely a consideration for us too, is we're happy to have people jump into our process, but that's actually part of my initial vetting process, is saying, hey, are you kind of involved in any clinical trials, et cetera? Because if you're named on an application, I can't actually have you serve with us. That is a COI. Right. So I'm actually glad you said that. That's something that typically doesn't come up until we're kind of at that point in the process. But yeah, it sounds like you're wondering how I cast my net and pull in some fabulous fish. So
yeah.
Part of it is, I think, that Intel junkie in me jumping into, we'll call it open source, or reaching out to personalities that I've seen that have served with the military and seeing, hey, would you be interested in this opportunity? And I've gotten everything from absolutely love to absolutely love to can't COVID, to no, I don't think it's for me. And then I've had people, you know, think I'm a bot. So part of my personal struggle is honestly what you folks are helping me out with is the reputation and the legitimacy, because we have information on our CDMRP website. We have highlights of consumer reviewers. We have highlights of the fantastic science that's coming out of all of this. We have all that fruit. It's getting people to listen and to look. So point for point, having, you know, cold call conversations. I know you guys have been curious about any organizations and such. I mean, even when I reached out to you, Matt, to say, hey, can we get involved in what you're gearing up for this year? And you answered the phone, you know, you answered my email, and I don't know how close you were, maybe not. So just getting my foot in the door and having those conversations and the amount of time and energy and honestly passion that takes to do and to keep caring. So yes, we have established relationships like Christopher Dana Reeve, organizations such as that, but I have reviewers where we don't even have an org necessarily initially. That's not part of my initial conversation. And then I turn it
affiliation with
right. Who do we have that can speak for you? Who do we have that can vouch for that? Yes, I've got this lived experience. I'm you know, a professional, someone can vouch for me. So we coordinate for those kind of things as well. So I won't jump too much more into at least the vetting process, but yeah, doing all that. I mean, that's, we have a whole recruitment season where I just jump in and I'm calling people left and right, sending emails and getting to know. Just, I cannot rave enough about the incredible stories that I get to hear and be privy to. And then to arm someone to step into a room of respectful ears and what comes from that. The right people at the right time in the same room. And it's incredible.
Unpack that for me. You just said arm them. What's that process like?
Absolutely. So that's actually why we have an organization vouch for individuals, right? So we don't want to necessarily have just anyone step in who maybe doesn't have a voice in terms of understanding a certain level of advocacy. They need to be able to speak for the community, right? It doesn't help if, you know, someone is just projecting their own experience onto situations. They need to be able to look around and have some empathy for their peers, peer mentors. You know, I'm looking for that sense of community if they're going to come in and share as well. So that's definitely part of it. But yeah, arming them. So first of all, letting them know I'm here and I'm listening, right? Like I'm that first face and foot to them that says, I want to hear your story. Please come to me, tell me. And then saying, hey, this is what we do. This is how we do it. Are you interested? Right? So there's that point of like, hey, this is work. This is not, you just get to show up and, hey, I'm here. This is homework. This is a lot of time already outside of your family and other responsibilities, your organization. And now with COVID, you know, I think some folks have been like, well, I was able to be more involved because we went digital, and that's that's got a strength too. But there's also a, well, my children are also sitting next to me now. My cat is trying to claw my eyes out. I had folks who, yeah, were available up until the point of almost no return. And like, hey, a family member got sick and now all of a sudden they can't even leave that area. So it's kind of just being prepared with all these people willing to step forward and as alternates too was huge. But yes, arming. I think just, yeah, reminding them too, when you're stepping into a process like this, and it's part of my initial vet to say, how are you? How comfortable are you with, you know, speaking to a room full of people? And what I try to prevent is them feeling like they shouldn't have a voice because they don't know the science, because they're going to read an application, they're not going to know maybe what half the words mean, and showing them that is not what your role is. You have everything you need before I even called you to ask you if you wanted to do it. So I think part of it is just reiterating, especially for our novices, you know, their first time through the program, and linking them up with a mentor who says, yep, I know you're nervous. Yep, I know you're scared. Yep, I know you don't know what those words are and you feel a little bit over your head. Trust the process. And when you get into the room, you'll see what it's about and it will all make sense. So it's getting someone to trust me to get them to trust themselves. So that's what I would deem as arming someone, is arming them with their own trust, their own voice.
So is there any kind of resource material that you use, particularly regarding the science and the process, and even the, you know, the reinforcing message of the value of their lived experience? Like, is there some kind of packet or reference material that you give them?
Well, we're jumping down a little bit of that rabbit hole that I can't throw into the ether, unfortunately. Okay, right. But first of all, I love that question. And two, to answer, yes. And one of my favorite things, and Jason was actually at the forefront of that this year, is once we get those conversations going and I get all my consumer reviewers into one room, and that bond is growing, and all of a sudden it's like, wait, you're involved with this, you're involved with that. And folks are jiving about like, would you be interested in seeing this? Or I found that this was helping me with this part of the process, and I get to kind of be that center point where people can send that information to, and then I can pump it back out to all the reviewers.
Well, just so it's clear, like, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but the reason why I'm so curious about this is that this is something we at U2FP think about all the time, most, like, at a high level for all of our initiatives, you know, like even the Working to Walk Symposium that you both graciously came and presented to, you know, just this presenting science and interacting with the SEI community and other stakeholders who don't maybe know that much about the science. But very pointedly, the place where we think about this a lot is, you know, we've just in the last few years passed these four state bills in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Minnesota, and Washington. And three of the four, we've been very deeply involved in the advisory boards, because we set up advisory boards with clinicians, scientists, and people with lived experience. And this sort of is a persistent question and puzzle and opportunity to say, okay, how do we get these folks ready for, you know, they might, depending upon how the program is structured, you know, my first experience back in 2015 was, you know, I had 12 proposals that were 35 and 40 pages each that I had to read and score, you know, as the family with lived experience member of the advisory board. And so we talk about this all the time from a systematic way, like, how can we help our community not just be there, like, not just be token, like, oh, you're in the room, and so we can stamp that box, you know, but that you actually have the invitation, you have the tools, and you have the sort of mandate to raise your voice and say what you think and bring your lived experience. And I could tell you lots of stories, but we won't go there, about how that's changed the whole dynamic. The whole conversation is different because there's a few people who have spoken up. you know. So that's actually just want to give you, that's why I'm asking and so interested in this, because it's something that we're steeped in all the time.
Absolutely.
Well, and also it appears to me that you folks are fairly unique in this. In this involvement of a lived experience person as a requirement for for funding. I mean, I learned about this first through I think it was SCI 2020, the NIH conference is the first time I heard that you folks existed, and that unique piece about requiring a community member to have involvement and voice. And man, that was a bookmark in my mind. And I remember thinking, gosh, I would love to be a part of that if at all possible back then when I had first heard about it. But it seems to be very unique. And it's extremely powerful. And I'm not so much asking a question as much as making a statement. That the voice of the community in research is huge, because it takes it from pure science, which asks questions of interest and desires to find out how the world works in a naturalistic view. It moves it from that pure science to applied solving answers for problems for real people. And where you do not have that voice saying, hey, look, man, walking is great, but honestly, I'd rather be able to go to the bathroom again, or I'd rather not have a 9 out of 10 on the pain scale all day from neuropathic pain, or I'd rather be able to, the list goes on and on, right? But you'd never know that if you didn't have somebody from the community saying, you know, that's great and all, but we could really use something else. And so, so that's a big statement, I guess, and maybe it would transition to a question to say, it seemed to be unique to you guys. How did that come about? And you know, when did that become about for SCRP?
Well, I'll take this one. So there are two aspects of this. One is the involvement of consumers in our review process. And this is not just within the review process, but also in setting the goals for the program. So setting that investment strategy, identifying what the needs of the consumer community are, and saying we need to fund into these specific areas. And that actually came very, very early on in the development of CDMRP. So that review that you're saying is so unique to SCRP actually is a hallmark of the CDMRP programs. The vast majority of our programs have consumer involvement in the review, as well as setting those investment strategies. And that was primarily because of our breast cancer advocates being so involved early on. But there's another aspect. So that's not unique to SCRP. That is a hallmark of CDMRP. What is unique to SCRP that you did bring up also is that starting just about 2 years ago, we started requiring that that SCRP-funded research involve a member of the SCI consumer community, as well as a member of the research team. And that is for our translational and clinical research. So where did that come from?
Yeah, who hatched that idea?
That was the programmatic panel. The programmatic panel saw the need that we have, the researchers and the community, there's a disconnect between those two. We need to get them in the same room. We need to get them talking to one another. And the way, as a funder, that we can do that is by making that a requirement within our funded research.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that I wish we could do that in our, I mean, that's something we've even just broached, is like, maybe we can, in our future state programs, something that we can mandate as well. as a requirement to deepen that relationship, because it is critical. It's so important.
So we've been talking quite a bit about the theory of all this and how it works, what its history was. Can you guys give us a where the rubber meets the road example, an anecdote of what's come along from this that's been important, that's been what you would call a win?
So one, let me just say again, if we're going to speak in generalities as we have been, wins for us are when we can move product closer to clinical implementation. So, for example, work that's coming out of the University of Washington around nerve transfer surgery for individuals with a high cervical injury, or the network neuroprosthesis out of Case Western. Both of those are techniques or technologies that were pioneered before coming to SCRP. And what we were able to do with our funding was to move them to the next stage of development, whether that be as a multi-site clinical trial or a first-in-human trial for those specific cases. So really, those are wins that we can say, look, we took these initial investments and we moved them into the patient space. And these are examples that skew heavily within functional recovery, but our investigators are also developing tools for psychosocial and sociological recovery, as well as self-management. But I must say that my absolute favorite project, and I don't know, my PIO might dock me on this. I might not be able to pick a favorite, but I'm going to tell you guys, and then she can tell me if I can't. But it's technology that's coming out of the University of Texas at Arlington. And it's work that's developing a fully automated seat cushion with real-time pressure mapping. So this relies on this really cool smart bubble technology to redistribute pressure automatically for users in an attempt to avoid pressure injuries, which, I mean, I don't have to tell you, the SCI community is extremely susceptible to, right? So I love this because it's a technology designed to prevent deleterious secondary health effects, but without adding additional burden for the user. So people are busy. If we can help design technology that lessens their physical or mental load, oh, that's perfect. Chef kiss perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of a sustaining technology. I mean, and what I mean by sustaining is, yeah, we're looking for cure. I mean, we're looking for functional recovery. We're looking for the thing that gives us back a semblance of the life that we had before a traumatic injury that took away our abilities. But in the meantime, we need to stick around long enough to be able to realize what's in the future, what will be in the future on those restorative, functional restoration. And some of that means, pressure mapping on a seat that was Christopher, that's what was Christopher Reeves, the thing that finally, I think took him out, ultimately, or at least it was involved, was that pressure sore and everything that came from that. So, I mean, it's a great example of kind of like this sustaining technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes to our mandate for the long-term care. Yes, we would love to regrow your spinal cord. Like, that would be fantastic. But in the meantime, let's get some little wins.
Sure. I know our conversation's getting along here, and I'm not sure how much more time that we have left. I know that I wanted to just very quickly say a little bit about my experience this year, obviously without getting into details of the who's the what's the wherefores, but in just a nutshell, I wanted to say that that experience was all I could have hoped for and more. The involvement, the professionalism, the panel, the folks that were on the panel, I mean, the level of professionalism and expertise and the questions that were asked and the criticisms that were raised, it was so enlightening and it was so refreshing to know that that's going on in the background and that this award funding is being critically assessed. Hopefully the good old boy system of, you know, is being kind of put aside for citizens actually getting involved at the levels that they can and critically assess. And I don't know. I was just, I was impressed.
I want to ask back to Melissa, your description and even your, you know, if it was approved to say your favorite project. I'm curious, because it makes me think about our process in, like, particularly in Minnesota, that there's been sometimes some tension between the strategy of putting out the small fires. You know, this is the way I think about it. Like, one of the things you described or a way to look at it is, you know, SEI, it creates a lot of small fires, right? But those fires can grow. So pressure sores or, you know, all the cascade of secondary complications. And in our Minnesota program, we came up with this statement to give preference. And of course, much less, you know, it's a lot less money and it's only one state. You know, $6 million split between SEI and TBI. But we came up with this statement as an advisory board that says, we'll give preference to research that seeks to change the nature and course of the injury. And that's because the mandate of, you know, kind of the program that we established is more towards the regeneration side, more towards, you know, maximizing curative interventions. And so we've had, there are times where we've had things like that come across, like, you know, a newfangled wheelchair or seat mapping strategies, or, you know, a device for catheterization, you know, or stuff like that. And so given all that preface, my question is there ever any like tension or debate between those areas of focus? Because we've seen that, like in our, we've had some robust conversations and disagreements on our advisory board around this very subject of what falls more towards a care end or a small fire put out, or towards a more, you know, rewarding, more bold, and not just bold questions, but also translatable. So I don't know if all that makes sense to you. And the question I'm asking is like, does that come up in, you know, the conversations between researchers and clinicians and people with lived experience? Are there conversations around that mandate and how it gets worked out? Or not?
So one thing is that everyone. Whether that be our peer reviewers, whether that be our programmatic advisory panel, they're in it for the impact. What will make the largest impact to the field? Mm. And what helps us is, and the field includes those researchers, but it includes the end user, it includes our consumers, it includes Congress. So we're balancing a lot of stakeholder needs. So what helps us is having those focus areas that say, these are the areas that we are going to ask for and fund in. We've always had those, you know, not just, you know, the regeneration focus areas. We've always had our bladder bowel, sexual function, well, bladder bowel definitely, as an area of investment, as well as other secondary health effects, because spinal cord injury is not just something that, you know, stops at your spine. This is a whole body problem mm-hmm. that needs whole person solutions.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to go like this one little tiny rabbit hole offshoot of the rabbit hole we're in. You said bowel, bladder, sexual function. Well, at least bowel, bladder. Can you unpack that right there? Is it because there's no research coming in on sexual function, or this is sort of curious sideline of mine because I've talked to a number of researchers about this problem. But there's not enough sexual function problem. Research.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct in that. But no, what I meant by that is just that that bowel and bladder have been focus areas. Sexual function fell off for a couple of years, but is back on by including genitourinary. So it wasn't necessarily a comment about whether sexual function is important. It absolutely is.
I wasn't questioning.
A field that we have absolutely funded in, actually. It's for me, as a ex-reproductive biologist, anytime a sexual function project comes in, I kind of get a little giddy.
Yeah,
it's kind of an interesting little rabbit hole we're in. And speaking as a person with lived experience, it is kind of interesting to me that sexual function on its own cannot stand as a research topic. I mean, even the kind of the renaming of, you know, genital urinary, I don't know, and this might not be the place actually to expand on this. Maybe we need to find out how to change or what the inputs are for the focus areas or something like that. But it does seem to me that the idea of sexual function in and of itself, I mean, it gets recategorized as like reproductive health. Well, I can tell you that I've got three kids. I don't need any help with like reproductive health, but like a sexual function and like the enjoyment of that experience is huge. I mean, that's a part of being a human, but when you have that taken away from you, you've had so much taken away from you. Like you've had so many physiological functions taken away, but to have that like actual enjoyment factor that for some people makes life worth living, to be like recategorized and filed away into an area that doesn't really get a lot of light, is a little frustrating. And I know it's frustrating for the community as a whole. And I know that some folks would put that above actual bowel and bladder, because we have ways of getting around that. We have catheters and we have other ways of getting around those things, you know, but just that point of enjoying life is so huge. I just thought while we're on the topic, I should just make that statement that it is very important.
And I know you were. You go.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sitting here rooting for you.
Well, Jason, I think we'll have to put a pin in this because I think we should have a podcast focused on this particular theme and try to unpack, maybe even have a couple of different guests unpack, sure. Like, because I've heard a lot of different things from researchers about, you know, all the way to there's almost like a Puritan kind of puritanical view from some funders or even agencies, like, and even within the research community, there people are like afraid to do it. But then there's also the fact that it's pretty complicated. Really difficult to measure, difficult to model. You know, there's a whole bunch of layers around. And then there's a question of male and female. You know, like I could tell you some other stories about, you know, where male sexual preference or preference to male sexual function given over female sexual function. Like there's
probably because the historical standard of using males in just studies in general, right? But yeah, I can see that.
There's a whole bunch there, so we'll have to Melissa,
sorry guys,
you're just having a sidebar.
I'm enjoying this conversation. I'm here for it.
Carry that banner.
Yeah, and don't think it was
that's
just,
right. Hey, the louder our voices are, the more likely we're going to fund it. Let's be honest, right? Our mandate from Congress comes from advocates. So you advocate for that sexual function program. I'll run it.
Sure. All right. And so just real quickly, just to revisit something that we did bring up earlier, is the voice that is responsible for, because obviously the lived experience reviewer, the consumer, right, has a voice within the individual studies, but at the higher level, the establishing of these focus areas, you said that there are clinicians involved, community members, researchers. Are you able to unpack that anymore? Like, in other words, how can we have more influence in those focus areas before they even get to the point of an application?
Jackie, do you want to use our favorite term for this, what we wanted to bring up this entire time?
I have it highlighted and everything, but I want to hear you say it, if that's...
Can you both say it together?
Says it.
Ready?
She says it.
One,
so
two, three, together.
Unsolicited feedback.
Sweet.
We're not asking what, you tell us what.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tell us what you want.
Is that a text? What do we got?
Yeah. So it's much easier to get in contact with Jackie because you guys have Jackie's contact information and she will be able to tell you her contact information. I cannot. But the way that you can get in contact with me is through the CDMRP website. And you can go to our public affairs mailbox and send us your feedback.
And we will put these in our liner notes for the podcast. So Melissa, make sure you send us, you know, the website. I know you probably have already, but, or Jackie, if we can share your email, you know, whatever the contact, the contact points are, send it to us. We'll put them in our liner notes so people know as they're listening to this part of the conversation about unsolicited feedback, they know where to click.
I wonder if we could say that in harmony.
All of us. It's our sign off now.
Like, yeah. One, hello,
two,
hello. All right.
Three. Unsolicited feedback.
Oh, gosh. Okay, that was horrible, but it was
terrible.
But hey, look, it got some attention. It got some attention.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So you're essentially, so people understand, you want people to reach out and say, hey, how come you're not funding this? Or how come you're not researching this? Or I love that you're researching this. Can you do more? Like that, you want that from as many people in the SCI community as you can get.
Absolutely. How else are we going to get away from tokenism? We only can have so many people on our programmatic panel, on our peer review panel. We need the voices of the community to tell us whether we're doing a good job or not.
Right. So did you hear that, everybody who's listening? Please.
Rise up.
Well, we are at the point of the spear here. And this program that you guys are involved with, I think, is so important. And I really hope that other funding opportunities are looking to the SCRP program, to the medical research programs as a model. And I really hope that you can have an influence in other areas beyond just the CDMRP and SCRP. And I'm sure that you do. And because obviously word travels quickly that funding is available and researchers know that you exist. Research institutions know that you exist. And so I hope that they can start using what you're doing as a model. And I do think that it is making changes. And I know that because I was a part of it, I was there. And so that's really cool.
Nice. And it's so great to receive your comments about your experience. That's something that as the program manager, I don't tend to get that one-on-one, especially now that we're not in person with our review process. So hearing that it was worthwhile for you and you felt that it was a positive process, it really does help me out and it inspires me.
Cool. And also for folks who don't know, Melissa gave a presentation at our last Work Into Walk symposium, the virtual one, which is up on YouTube. We'll put that in the liner notes as well. And Melissa and Jackie were both on the panel that followed subsequent presentations from NIH and the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation and you two and who else? The Jack Jablonski Foundation. Kind of a conversation about strategy and funding, and which went a little off the rails, I must say, but I wish there would have been a little more of you two, to be honest.
Oh, thank you.
That's okay. Take just, two. We got it. You got us one-on-one. It's fine.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Just
right.
Keep inviting us back. We'll keep on coming.
One last question. So keeping it in this sphere, like how do people find out what you have funded? How do they have access to sort of any reporting? Can they sign up to get access, or do they have to go to a website, or is it locked down? Like, give us a rundown on that.
Yeah, sure. You can see every single award that SCRP and CDMRP has funded in the past on the CDMRP website. You can get their technical as well as the public abstracts. The public abstracts are written for a lay audience. I hate that term, but it's written for a non-scientific audience. So you don't need to be an expert in the field to understand it. And then to spread sort of, you know, the good news of SCRP, we tweet on the CDMRP Twitter feed. We develop a program book every couple of years. We just developed a brand new sparkly shiny program book with some fantastic science. And again, those are written for a general audience.
Cool. Okay. So you'll have to send us or make sure we have all that stuff too as well. So
I will send you. You're going to be bombarded.
good. Okay, this is my last question, I promise. Because as you were describing that, it also made me think, what kind of, like when you talked about the project at Case, for instance, it reminded me that we just recently had we're kind of in the middle of organizing these follow-up calls with our Ohio advisory board, where we passed a $3 million appropriation, where the SC, you know, people with lived experience who are on the advisory board, which was like six or seven of them. We've organized these calls with each of the five recipients of the money, or the first round of money, so that the people with lived experience can follow up and find out, okay, well, what's going on with your project? Where is it? What's, depending upon where it is, like what's gonna happen next? And two of those were out of Case. And one of them was an implantable FES system that's trying to translate to commercial development. So I'm curious, is there any kind of follow-up with your panels or advisories or even what levels of accountability that include all the stakeholders into those projects to ensure or encourage them to move further down the pipeline?
So we have our normal reporting process. So most of our awards report to us, us being the SCRP program team, on a quarterly and annual basis. So what are you doing? And that's only during the period of performance. So that's only when they're actually doing the thing.
Right.
It's after the award ends, though, following up on those is quite tricky, as I'm sure you're aware with your experiences.
Yeah.
And it's not unique to our funding agency. But what is great is that our researchers are actually they are excited about the research that they're doing. So they contact us and tell us what they're doing, you know, next, and what follow-on funding they have received. And we really do rely on them to report back after the award has ended. But when the award is ongoing, yeah, they're beholden to us to report out on what they're doing and what their plans are for moving this technology forward.
Mm. Cool. I think we've covered it all. You guys happy with, do you think we've covered it all?
I think we all crushed it.
Wow, crushed it. Nice. Jason, anything more? Any last comments?
No, not so much. I think it was great. Super appreciate you guys taking the time to come out and chat with us. And I really hope that this is part of the awareness kind of campaign. I hope that our reach is expanded and that we echo what you guys are doing and the importance of it. And it's great.
Thank you so
Jason,
much.
Jason, would you review for SCARP again?
Oh, I would do that in a heartbeat. Yep, absolutely.
Well, don't worry, you'll get an invite, and I'm absolutely going to ask you to mentor. So,
nice. Okay.
I'll do what I can. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, I would do that. It was a great process. I was actually just thinking about that. Like, it's a little bit my nature to something I love. I am an evangelist for, So Matt and I, when we do these podcasts, you know, it's important for us to hold people accountable, right? I mean, and to try to ask tough questions, try to ask critical questions and be critical and stuff. But stuff that I really like, it's especially if it's working, it's hard for me to be critical of. So I was thinking, you know, Matt and I could be like good cop, bad cop.
Jack, except you're the only one that's ever been a cop.
Hey, you're blowing my cover, man. Yeah, no, but so it sounds like I'm just lauding the program and everything, but it truly is because I was impressed with it. And I really encourage any of the folks that are listening that want to have that voice and are willing to speak up beyond their own injury or their own injury level or their own, you know, unique limitations, and learning about their community and speaking up on behalf of their community to jump in there, because this is truly a place where you can, it's truly a place where you can make a difference. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Out.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun.